2:59 p.m. on April 6, 2018, the FBI's Phoenix field office announced that earlier that day, they had raided the home of Backpage.com co-founder Michael Lacy. I'm going to let Melissa Gira Grant, staff writer at The New Republic, author of Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work, and co-host on this episode, take us through that day. You'll also be hearing from Danielle Blunt, a sex worker and organizer with Hacking Hustling. Okay, so Melissa, the FBI makes this announcement. There's some local news coverage outside Michael Lacy's house, but there's a lot more going on that day online.
Right. There's a lot more going on, and if you were on social media, you would have seen it. You'd see sex workers learning that the website they relied on had just been shut down for good. But they found out before the Phoenix FBI even announced what they'd done.
When I was logging onto social media, just seeing people sharing screenshots of Backpage, like, this site has been raided by the FBI, this site has been seized by the feds, and seeing sex workers be like, is this what's showing up for you? This is what's showing up for me. What's going on? What's happening?
3:22 p.m. It's not as dramatic as the federal agents surrounding someone's house, but the shutdown is official. The name servers for Backpage.com are redirected to SeizedServers.com.
That's what I remember, too, is some people were like, well, it's working for me. Like, I don't know what's going on for you. And sharing, like, different screenshots of what the page looked like.
Sex workers flood Twitter with questions and speculation. This isn't the first time a site like Backpage has gone down, and they know the drill. Some people have money still in their Backpage accounts for ads they intended to place. They don't know if they can get it back.
What's going on? What's happening? Like, what are we going to do? Why isn't this website working? Like, I need to make rent.
As in most raids like this, the uncertainty and the chaos only makes absorbing the news worse. At 3:44, I called the Department of Justice press office. But they won't confirm that Backpage is even shut down, nor give any further comment. They simply advise me, load Backpage.com.
This episode of RipCorp is about Backpage and the path that led to its dramatic closure in 2018. We are tremendously lucky to have Melissa as a guest host on this episode. Aside from being a longtime friend, her thoughtful and incisive coverage of sex work and criminal justice has been incredibly important for public understanding of both topics and, frankly, to shifting the media narrative away from simplified stereotypes. And the fall of Backpage both led to a turning point in that coverage while also foreshadowing future media flashpoints.
The Backpage story is saturated with myths and disinformation. Years before QAnon, myths and distortions about children being sold for sex fueled a politically motivated moral panic. In the name of protecting kids, yet largely targeting sex workers, not sex traffickers. And the media was a critical tool in defining and waging that fight.
Yeah, at its heart, Backpage isn't just a tech story or a sex work story. It's a media story. Although the actual site didn't go up until 2004, Backpage's origin story goes further back to the pre-internet heyday of local alternative newspapers. So first, a little background. City probably has, or until recently had, one of these free, weekly, and usually kind of lefty magazine-style newsprint publications. If you wanted to know what was really going on and what was actually cool in your city, you didn't read the Baltimore Sun or the San Francisco Chronicle. You read Baltimore City Paper or the East Bay Express. And in New York, you didn't read the New York Times. You read the Village Voice. One of the first and best-known alt-weeklies, The Voice was founded in 1955 by a group of writers and rabble-rousers, including counterculture icon and wife-stabber Norman Mailer. It came to be a valued source of muckraking, independent journalism, and wide-ranging cultural reporting recognized well beyond the city. The Voice played a role in Backpage's eventual downfall, but Backpage's story began with a different publication, the alt-weekly Phoenix New Times. Founded in 1970 by Michael Lacy and Jim Larkin, they imbue the paper with this sort of prankster, libertarian, free speech above all vibe. Not so much of the literary pretension or explicitly left positioning as The Voice, but they certainly enjoyed skewering authority. through the 1980s and 1990s, alt weeklies went through a period of consolidation. Bigger alt weeklies were buying up publications in cities across the country. Larkin and Lacey were at the forefront of the consolidation spree. They acquired Denver's Westword, the Dallas Observer, and SF Weekly. It was the late 1990s, and publishing was suddenly really flush. What could possibly go wrong? Well, we'll tell you. The internet. And with it, Craigslist. Craigslist was bad news for newspapers with classified listings, but Larkin and Lacey saw an opportunity. Well, actually, Carl Ferrer did. In the early 2000s, Carl was a classified ad salesman at the New Times-owned Dallas Observer. He proposed an in-house competitor to Craigslist, an online classifieds aggregator. So they made one, naming it after the place in alt weeklies where classifieds were placed, the back page. While it was financially successful, it didn't rapidly become a household name like Craigslist did. A year later, in 2005, New Times Media announced their acquisition of The Village Voice. Upon doing so, the company borrowed their new acquisition's household name status and rebranded as Village Voice Media. A few years later, Backpage was a household name too, though not really in a good way.
We are asking The Village Voice Media Company to no longer host ads that facilitate sex trafficking and to become part of the solution rather than the problem, to engage in responsible corporate practices.
Shut it down! Shut it down! Shut it down! Shut it down!
This is tape of a 2012 protest outside the Village Voice's offices in New York City, the famous ones that have like the name of the magazine on the front. And these people are protesting the Village Voice for their role in apparently new slavery, I guess. So Melissa, you were actually there at this protest. You were on the scene. Can you tell us what you remember from then?
Oh my God. It was super hot. And there were maybe only like 150 people there. But there were some college kids with a Christian youth group passing out water. There were elected officials there. And there were these groups that, you know, I guess you could describe them as anti-human trafficking groups. But for the most part, to hear them talk, they actually wanted to get rid of sex work. And then sort of off to the side, there was actually a group of sex workers. They were there counter-protesting. And it wasn't like they had like pro-Backpage signs or anything like that. They were just like protesting the people protesting Backpage. Because for them, this was how they made a living.
And this actually had its foundations in the old alt weeklies.
Right. So the old alt weeklies we were talking about from the very beginning, they also carried ads for escorts and doms and all sorts of adult services in the physical back page. While these ads set many alt weeklies apart from the more straight-laced legacy newspapers, it's unclear if the decision to carry the ads had much to do with sticking it to the man, as it did the sex workers just provided a reliable revenue resource. Craigslist and Backpage, both essentially online carbon copies of the alt-weekly classifieds, also had adult services sections. And for sex workers, this was a really big deal, because instead of having to solicit clients on the street, sex workers could post their own ads online, and then sex workers could screen clients online. Posts were ephemeral and anonymous, and made it easy to keep one's personal life and professional life separate. And sex workers could even connect with each other online, posting warnings about clients to avoid and finding each other and building community. But pivoting to digital also brought more surveillance, an immobilized moral umbrage. Most people don't have strong opinions about what does and doesn't belong in a local print paper's classified section, but nearly everyone has an opinion about what does and doesn't belong online, and lots of people have opinions about sex work. Putting those two together created the legal and political maelstrom that we're unpacking in this episode. This was, let's remember, the early 2000s, when anything with an online angle was novel, and inevitably media coverage treated online sex work as a particularly salacious novelty. Craigslist specifically became a novel tool for cops, who would on occasion catfish sex workers to engage in sting operations.
prostitution on Craigslist. More than a dozen women busted in Deerfield Township. News says Laura Borchers is live with our number 5 story tonight. Laura.
More news tonight. Sex for sale on the internet, and not on a pornography site, but a popular website used by millions of people every day.
Authorities say all it takes is $10 and you can advertise your services as a prostitute on Craigslist. As Natalie Shepard tells us, that's going to be a bit more challenging for the 34 people arrested in a sting operation.
Craigslist, a social website where people can find a place to live, buy electronics, and even find a job. But police say people are also trying to make a living selling themselves.
Extremely popular. People sell everything on here, from cars to furniture, but also sex.
Despite the fact that Craigslist seemed to be a pretty effective tool for cops to make prostitution arrests, the company still drew a lot of scrutiny from top law enforcement officials, like state attorneys general. And Craigslist, to their credit, tried to respond to the scrutiny in good faith. In 2008, they started charging money for the ads in an effort to add some friction into the posting process to make it easier to track the identity of the advertisers, which really just ate into sex workers' income, and it made them feel under greater law enforcement scrutiny. Even though Craigslist later arranged to donate revenue from those ads to charity, the image that they were somehow generating money from sex work only led to more scrutiny. And so in March 2009, Craigslist was sued by Tom Dart, the sheriff of Cook County, Illinois.
Melissa, let's just take a second. We're going to play a little tape of the press conference when Tom Dart announces this lawsuit. And I want us to just kind of like talk a little bit about the language he's using and some of the choices he's making.
We're talking about charges we have for human trafficking, for arresting for juvenile pimping, for prostitution. We have all of it here. We have arrested 16-year-old girls, 15-year-old girls who have been posted on Craigslist.
So if you listen carefully to this press conference, you can hear Dart talking interchangeably about sex work and sex trafficking. And you also hear him admit that his solution to both is to arrest everyone, even minors.
Right. So this conflation of sex work and sex trafficking is something that people had kind of already been doing when Craigslist was sort of the subject of controversy. And this is going to kind of become a bigger thing as the story goes on. But circa 2009, Dart has declared Craigslist a public nuisance and the, quote, largest source of prostitution in the nation. And he sought a court order shutting down the erotic services section and asking for around $100,000 in reimbursement to the sheriff's office for investigator costs.
And yet we have this website that facilitates this. And somehow we're all supposed to feel good about it because it's a legitimate business. Since when have we felt good about a legitimate business that facilitates a criminal act as an accomplice? How is this any different than two individuals that enter into an agreement to conduct prostitution where one will handle the women and the other one is going to advertise for them?
Well, there actually was a big difference, and that's why Dart's lawsuit was dismissed. That difference hinged specifically on a kind of obscure part of federal law, colloquially known as Section 230. Okay, so spoiler alert. Section 230 plays zero role in ending Backpage. But Backpage ends up having a big impact on Section 230. So we have to take a little bit of a detour here to explain what it is. Kendra Albert is a clinical instructor at the Cyber Law Clinic at Harvard Law School. We asked them to give us the 230 rundown.
Section 230 is a law that was first passed in 1996 as part of the Communications Decency Act, which was supposed to protect children from porn online. It did a really great job of that. No, actually, it was struck down as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. But the one part of it that remains is Section 230. It's actually part of the Telecommunications Act. And it says that no provider of an internet service shall be held liable as like the publisher or speaker of stuff on the internet.
Okay, first, yes, in 1996, the federal government tried to regulate porn off of the then very new internet because children might see it. Second, why does it matter that providers can't be sued over my shit posts? Well, in the case of Tom Dart's lawsuit against Craigslist, the court determined that Craigslist couldn't be sued over sex works ads because Craigslist wasn't personally writing the ads, and having an erotic services section didn't by default mean that Craigslist was encouraging illegal activity. There are plenty of completely legal services that fit under that category, like a stripper hired for a bachelor party. Ads for illegal stuff were, in fact, a violation of Craigslist's own terms of service. And while they admittedly struggled to keep up with content moderation, just like any large-scale platform does, ultimately, civil lawsuit liability lay with whoever posted the ad.
I felt it was fundamentally about personal responsibility.
This is one of the authors of Section 230, Ron Wyden, one of Oregon's United States senators.
Back in the 90s, Ron Wyden was a House representative when he and fellow Congressman Chris Cox created Section 230.
The person who posts the content, and nobody knew, of course, that there would be millions of postings around the clock and around the world constantly, should be held personally, liable.
It also was about reducing risk for people trying to start online businesses in the 1990s, when the internet was still a super new idea. Like, Craig Newmark probably wouldn't have even made Craigslist if he had to worry about getting sued all the time over stuff other people posted on Craigslist.
And from the very beginning, I felt that what 230 was all about was giving an opportunity to make sure that voices that didn't have money and power and clout could get out.
Section 230 means that the internet as we know it exists. YouTube can't be sued for X, Facebook can't be sued for Y, Twitter not for Z, and Craigslist couldn't be sued over the sex work ads on its website. But 230 didn't stop state attorneys general offices from scrutinizing the company and publishing open letters demanding that Craigslist change its website to not accommodate sex work.
Craigslist made a lot of changes in response to those letters and Tom Dart's lawsuit. They started charging for ads, requiring a credit card, and they renamed erotic services to adult services. They boosted their content moderation efforts so that every adult post was reviewed by a human being. But no amount of changes would appease their critics. And ultimately, on September 3rd, 2010, Craigslist abruptly shut down its adult section with a little fanfare. Just the word censored where the link for adult services previously was. And while Craigslist never formally issued a statement explaining their decision, they may have recognized that the tone of these attacks was shifting in a direction the company just couldn't fight. Less than 2 weeks after the shutdown, Craigslist representatives testified at a House subcommittee hearing on domestic minor sex trafficking. They weren't just being accused of facilitating sex work ads. Now they had to testify before Congress about their alleged role in aiding and abetting sex trafficking. Maybe they just no longer wanted to fight. Predictably, the ads sex workers had once found an audience for on Craigslist now moved on to other sites. And the groups opposed to sex work ads followed sex workers to those same sites, too.
Prostitution and underage sex trafficking taken off the street and onto the World Wide Web. When the popular classified site Craigslist shut down its erotic ads, Backpage.com took over.
Just a few keystrokes and a few mouse clicks away is a world where a man's fantasies can come true.
They're trying to have the sex that their wives and girlfriends have said no to.
How would you feel, for example, as a mother, if you saw an ad like this, or an ad like this, or, this girl, she says she's 19.
Disappearing into the internet sex trade, our Nightline investigation into the controversial classified site, Backpage.com.
Now, before we move on, we need to say this. There is no evidence that this pressure on Craigslist did anything to help people who were trafficked. In fact, it may have made things even worse, depending on the type of anti-trafficking group that you ask. Now, some organizations working on human trafficking are genuinely trying to provide resources, a place to stay, GED classes, just straight up money, to people who've been through really shitty situations. But a lot of the groups that were most vocal about Craigslist and Backpage were associated with the Christian right, like the group International Justice Mission, who don't hire non-Christians as policy, or groups which were apparently secular but stigmatize sex workers and associate them with sex trafficking, like when the former executive director of the anti-trafficking group Polaris Project described sex workers as victims trapped in, quote, nasty, immoral lives.
This moralizing and conflation of sex work and sex trafficking also drives a narrative that all sex workers need saving from their circumstances, which often overlooks the reality that sometimes people, including minors, end up trading sex to save themselves. But for groups who see anyone engaged in sex trade as a victim, they see sex work as the problem.
If you can't understand that life with a pimp is better than life at home, then you don't understand this problem.
Lois Lee is the president and founder of Children of the Night, a Los Angeles-based organization that's been providing services to trafficking survivors since the 1970s. In her view, a lot of anti-trafficking groups focused on sites like Backpage also tended to emphasize so-called relatable victims, those whose stories can be told in a more simplistic, sensational way. Innocent, suburban, or middle-class, usually white, girls who, through some disastrous turn of events, were lured into a dark trap by a nefarious trafficker. But in her experience,
the kids are oftentimes willing victims because they're escaping horrific homes.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make it okay. It doesn't make anybody good.
But the kinds of groups who promote these sanitized survivor stories, emphasizing purity and innocence lost, it also helps justify the solutions those groups already have in mind. Tougher laws, tougher law enforcement. Rather than trying to address the conditions of abuse or poverty that make trading sex to escape or survive seem like a decent option. What trafficking survivors don't need is better resourced cops to save them. They need stability, agency, material resources. And sex work, while precarious and risky, sometimes it's the most practical option for obtaining those things. But this level of nuance, this full spectrum of people's experiences of sex work and trafficking, all this was almost entirely absent from the sex trafficking panic of the 2010s, which you can hear in those protests outside the Village Voice offices. And despite a lot of organizations demonizing Craigslist and Backpage, the websites did provide them with something extremely valuable for their cause: data. It's obviously really, really hard to measure an underground economy when the whole thing is about staying under the radar. But with online classifieds, anyone who could cobble together a basic web scraper could, in theory, gather all sorts of statistics. This coincided nicely with the rise of Silicon Valley solutionism. Now people could claim they were ending trafficking with apps and hackathons. The trouble is, these groups were just gathering ads, which are a messy and unreliable data source, and it's astonishingly easy to fudge the numbers on those without anyone checking.
Case in point. In March 2011, Nick Pinto, a reporter now based in Brooklyn, and it happens, someone Melissa and I have both known for about a decade, was working at Village Voice Media-owned City Pages, based in Minneapolis. One day, he got an email from a PR rep about a report commissioned by the Women's Funding Network, which had been cited at that 2010 congressional hearing about domestic minor sex trafficking. The report argued that online classified ads had enabled a huge spike in sex trafficking of underage women in 3 states. Nick decided to check it out.
And so they sent me the study, and I started digging into the methodology, and it was just garbage.
For instance, the study asked 100 participants to look at photos of young women and guess whether they were under 18. Then they used the result of this guessing to state that every young-looking woman selling sex online has a 38% chance of being under 18. If you're confused, you should be, because it's garbage. But it wasn't just the fact it was garbage that offended Nick.
I don't know if you guys have this experience, but it pissed me off as a journalist. I was like, you just tried to fucking spin me, and I resent that, and then I'm going to exact my revenge.
Revenge in 2011 looked like writing a blog post. Nick gave his editor a heads up, though, about his forthcoming post.
And then things got weird.
This is where this anecdote stops being, here's some bad trafficking data, and becomes a reminder that the Backpage story is also a media story. A little while later, Nick's editor came back to him and said, hey, what if we did this as a print piece? Well, reporter doesn't want to hear that. So Nick did some more reporting. And then his editor said, hey, maybe let's do a cover story. Then higher-ups decided that Nick's story about a shitty methodology was going to be a mandatory chain-wide cover story. That meant all 13 Village Voice media papers nationwide would run it. And look, it was a well-reported piece, but this is a pretty wild and unusual trajectory for what honestly probably could have just been a blog post.
the thing is, Nick's would-be blog post was very useful to Jim Larkin and Michael Lacey, Village Voice Media's owners and Nick's bosses' bosses. The story refuted a major talking point of Backpage's critics, so Backpage's owners decided to use their papers as basically a bully pulpit for Backpage. On the one hand, Backpage was trying to address concerns around child sex trafficking. They upped their content moderation. They created automated filters for specific terms and ads. They reported ads to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, also known as NCMEC. But Larkin and Lacey still had that libertarian bro, anti-authoritarian streak, which led to big fuck you gestures like putting out a story undermining an anti-Backpage talking point on 13 alt-weekly covers. This kind of sucked for Nick, because no matter how accurate his reporting was, the packaging around it and the obvious publisher self-interest made it a lot easier for Backpage critics to dismiss it. Not to mention that it made him look like a total narc to his colleagues. Let the record show, Nick Pinto is not, and has never been, a narc.
It also sucks because the kind of reporting that Nick was doing at that time was really important and really needed. There were a lot of media outlets that were just running with those statistics without questioning them. And in fact, I didn't even know Nick at the time, and I passed that story around because it was one of the only ones to really question this, you know, garbage data. We should also note here that this was not the first time that Larkin and Lacey used their papers like this. In 2009, when Backpage was still a junior competitor to Craigslist, Village Voice Media ran a chain-wide story about people murdered by strangers they connected with on Craigslist. It featured quotes from people and organizations that would go on to be major adversaries to Backpage. The actual story was pretty nuanced, but the framing around it emphasized this scourge of Craigslist killers. And online, it ran with a Craigslist murders slideshow.
So I think it is significant to point out, you know, they're perfectly content to sort of trade on some of that fear-mongering when it served their financial interests.
The point here is that throughout this period, Larkin and Lacey styled themselves as free speech heroes, fighting for Backpage, even as they took swipes at other sites which did the same thing. And while keeping Backpage up did help a lot of sex workers, ultimately, Larkin and Lacey were protecting their business interests, first and foremost. Eventually, those business interests made owning the papers themselves and owning Backpage untenable. In September 2012, Lacey and Larkin sold the newspapers to a group of internal executives, and they spun off Backpage as a separate company. While this may also have had something to do with Backpage being way, way more profitable than newspapers, managing papers while also in constant legal battles over Backpage had become pretty onerous. And those battles did not let up. And in fact, things only escalated. Perhaps the most dramatic difference between the campaigns against Backpage compared to Craigslist is that more and more people were pushing for changes to the previously untouchable Section 230, the telecommunications law provision that had protected Craigslist from civil suits. Section 230 protected Backpage from civil suits, too. And in 2013, attorneys general from 45 states and two U.S. territories sent a letter to Congress recommending that 230 be amended specifically to facilitate the prosecution of Backpage.
Some context for those attorneys general. We spent some time, well, actually, researcher Sam Schuyler spent some time looking into the career paths of attorneys general who signed onto the open letter in 2010 against Craigslist's adult services section and the ones who signed that 2013 Backpage letter to Congress. Some of the signatories are kind of disgraced now. What up, Eric Schneiderman, Pat Bondi, Ken Cuccinelli? But others are the current governor of Texas, the governor of South Carolina, the governor of Maine, the governor of North Carolina, the governor of Ohio, and one is vice president now.
And I will repeat what I've said many times. Backpage.com needs to shut itself down when it has created as its business model the profiting off the selling of human beings and the purchase of human beings.
That's Kamala Harris in 2012. In October 2016, while running for her future Senate seat, Harris and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton joined forces to arrest Larkin, Lacey, and Carl Ferrer, the adman-turned-CEO who came up with Backpage, on conspiracy charges, plus a pimping charge for Ferrer. During their arraignment in Sacramento, they were put in a jail cell in the courtroom, seemingly just to hammer home that these were bad men being put behind bars. That December, a judge dismissed the charges, citing Section 230. In the intervening time between the arrests and the dismissal, Harris had been elected the junior senator of the great state of California.
We're not saying that the war against Backpage was the sole reason that former attorneys general got elected to higher office. State attorney general is, after all, a very popular political launchpad. But going after Backpage was a low-risk, high-reward political credential burnisher. While sex workers appreciated the convenience and safety offered by websites like Backpage, politicians and prosecutors also found it a convenient political punching bag, even if the hits they landed fell hardest on the people they claimed they wanted to help. The steady attacks rapidly sped up in Backpage's final year. In January 2017, the investigations arm of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs published a report following a nearly two-year-long investigation of Backpage. It argued, among other things, that Backpage knowingly enabled crimes through its automated filtering of specific terms by refusing to let users publish posts with phrases like "barely legal," the report argued. Backpage was, in fact, coaching child traffickers to better cover their tracks. Backpage got rid of its adult section within days of the report dropping, although sex work ads continued to appear discreetly in the personal section. Lark and Lacey and Ferrer didn't really help their cause by insisting on pleading the fifth for the entirety of their Senate testimony a few days later.
A month after the Senate report dropped, the documentary I Am Jane Doe appeared in select theaters. Executive produced and narrated by Jessica Zero Dark 30 Chastain. No, seriously. It told, in part, the story of Doe v. Backpage, a lawsuit brought by underage trafficking survivors and one of their parents. In the film, Section 230 was presented as the only thing standing between survivors and justice.
This is the United States. There's no possible way this is true.
I sent her out with one of her friends, and she didn't come back.
Next thing you know, boom. She brought her into a life of hell.
It was like shopping on Amazon.
You're just a product.
Well, the most popular internet site for escorts is called Backpage.com, where authorities say underage girls are sold for sex.
Other celebrities were getting on board for this with a PSA that conflated 230 and trafficking and featured Amy Schumer, Seth Meyers, and Tony Shalhoub.
Today, you can go online and buy a child for sex. It's as easy as ordering a pizza.
It is inconceivable to me that this is happening here in this country.
According to I Am Jane Doe publicity materials, in April 2017, supposedly a few months after a screening of the film on Capitol Hill, Missouri Representative Ann Wagner introduced the Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, also known as FOSTA. A few months later, the Senate introduced their own version of FOSTA, the Stop Enabling Sex Trafficking Act, or SESTA. Both bills proposed carving out an exception in Section 230 for sex trafficking and promoting prostitution. The bill's supporters said denying websites like Backpage these protections would make it possible to prosecute them. SESTA-FOSTA, they're generally talked about together as a single bill, was pretty much exclusively written to prosecute Backpage. But its chilling effects on other websites and its impact on sex workers was obvious before it was even signed into law. Within hours of the bill passing the Senate in March 2018, Reddit banned several sex work-oriented subreddit communities. Within days, Craigslist removed its entire personal section. And after it passed the House, representatives celebrated those shutdowns as the direct result of the new law.
Things weren't looking good for Backpage. Between the Senate report and media coverage, they had basically already been convicted in the court of public opinion as the Walmart of sex trafficking, actual thing said in I Am Jane Doe. Legislation tailor-made to destroy the company was within days of being signed into law.
And the truly wild thing is, ultimately, none of that factored into the April 6th seizure and shutdown that opened this episode, but it absolutely fueled the chaotic fallout which followed. As members of Congress had their mission accomplished moment passing Sesta Fosta, the dust was still settling from the seizure of Backpage on April 6th. It took another 3 days before the Justice Department announced official charges against Larkin Lacey and Carl Ferrer: money laundering, conspiracy, and 50 violations of the Travel Act, which, contrary to its name, is not even about travel. The Travel Act's original purpose was to help federal and state governments go after organized crime, basically by making it illegal to use roads to do crime. It's been on the books since 1961. Today, it's generally just used by the feds to charge people for prostitution.
All of this is to say, Backpage's founders and CEO weren't charged under any federal sex trafficking statutes. All of that hullabaloo over Sesta Fosta, needing legislation to stop the scourge of internet sex trafficking, they didn't even end up needing it. Sesta Fosta formally became law 5 days after the Backpage seizure, after the feds took them down with a 57-year-old law for highways. Still, Sesta Fosta and the seizure of Backpage were conflated into a grand victory moment by the savior complex side of the trafficking advocacy world, those groups who want to eradicate sex work, and their supporters. A few weeks after the law passed, Megyn Kelly had Mary Mazzeo, the director of I Am Jane Doe, on her show Megyn Kelly Today to take a uniquely cringe victory lap.
President Trump gets credit for doing nothing. This was a good thing to do.
Deal.
It was.
And I have to say, I'm a lefty, and so I don't really agree with many of the president's policies. I will say, when we were in there in the Oval Office, he was compassionate. He was kind to Nicole and Jessica and all of the other survivors there. He kept rubbing the back of one of the mothers, and I thought, this is...
Would you stop?
Okay.
Stop that. Not like that.
But was Sesta Fosta really good stuff for the people it was claiming to help? Well, it turns out you can just ask. One of the provisions of Sesta Fosta required that the Government Accountability Office evaluate its impact 3 years on. That report was published earlier this year. The results? Well...
As of this spring, Sesta Fosta has been used in one criminal prosecution. And it wasn't against Backpage. So what did Sesta Fosta do if it didn't take down Backpage? Well, the GAO said that during this period, quote, gathering tips and evidence to investigate and prosecute those who control and use online platforms has become more difficult due to the relocation of platforms overseas, platforms' use of complex payment systems, and the increased use of social media platforms, end GAO quote. So why had things become so much more complicated? The GAO came to the same conclusion that sex workers' rights advocates like Danielle Blunt did. What caused that disruption was either Sesta Fosta or the seizure of Backpage, or both. But the two events just came too close together to know for sure. The GAO report helps validate many of the concerns shared by sex workers and survivors of trafficking. As it notes, rather than helping identify and prosecute traffickers, what Sesta Fosta did was make it harder for sex workers to post ads. So, as for its alleged purpose of fighting sex trafficking and providing a path to justice for victims, Sesta Fosta has yet to accomplish either. But in terms of fighting online sex work, well, if that was your goal, which, as a reminder, many, if not most, of the law's supporters said eradicating sex work was necessary in order to fight sex trafficking, for those groups, Sesta Fosta was a tremendous success.
I truly hate what online work has turned into, whether or not you're like working online on OnlyFans or just trying to advertise yourself online.
Danielle Blunt, who you heard at the top of this episode, has had to adapt to a very different landscape for sex work online, both post-Backpage and more recently post-pandemic. We actually spoke to her as she was preparing to return to in-person work.
Yeah, it's my first time back working in person. I think I've seen one or two regulars since the pandemic started because I'm immunocompromised, so I've been in hard quarantine mode. But now that I'm vaccinated, we're in my out call right now, and I was just talking about how nice it would be to be able to just post an ad up on Backpage because it's like a last minute trip. And now I have to like have a fucking Substack to send emails to my newsletter.
Blunt uses a lot of different platforms to advertise. And on most of them, she has to carefully curate and monitor her accounts in case they get suspended or shadow banned. Post-Backpage, sex workers trying to work online are constantly at the mercy of the algorithm and discriminatory content moderation practices.
But not having access to those spaces to advertise and like that low barrier to entry just makes so much more work for people who are often just trying to get their money and move on with their life.
Losing Backpage didn't just make it harder to make money. It also made it less safe. Hacking Hustling, the collective that Blunt co-founded, and full disclosure, Ingrid and I were also involved in its founding. They published a report in 2020 on the impact of Sesta Fosta and the Backpage takedown on sex workers' safety and income. The effects on both were felt immediately.
Clients were actually preying on the precarity of sex workers in like these 2 months, that when rent was due, there was more contact from abusive clients who were trying to negotiate on sex workers' rates, knowing that sex workers' options were drastically reduced in the previous days. So everything that Fosta Sesta purported to do to stop human trafficking actually made the people who were trading sex more vulnerable to circumstances of labor exploitation, like very directly.
So much for that congressional victory lap. Only two senators voted against Sesta Fosta. One of them was Ron Wyden, the guy who co-wrote Section 230. Wyden has supported and introduced other legislation to crack down on sex trafficking and to support victims. And he understood that Sesta Fosta's approach wasn't going to actually do either of those things. It also set a really, really bad precedent for Section 230.
But every time something horrendous that shocks the conscience comes up, there's a big march to say it's 230's fault. And I'm always trying to, you know, lay out, are we going to try to solve problems here? Or are we going to just try to throw out, you know, sound bites that, you know, presumably are used for political campaigns and the like?
Sorry, we have to do another 230 record scratch moment, but I promise it's important. When Congress was debating Sesta Fosta, 230, which, in case you forgot, is the law that makes it so that you can say stuff on the internet and Facebook doesn't get sued, it became kind of a big tech boogeyman, blamed for the rise of unaccountable monopoly platforms like Facebook. Companies like Facebook and Google could have come out swinging against Sesta Fosta as a threat to their livelihoods, and initially they did. But tech platforms faced a lot more scrutiny after the 2016 election. Misinformation, hate speech, Cambridge Analytica, we could go on. And in the wake of this tech lash, companies apparently made a political calculation, and they came out instead in support of Sesta Fosta, perhaps to stave off more onerous regulation conversations, essentially giving Congress a win. Big platforms probably also recognized that ultimately, Sesta Fosta wouldn't harm their bottom line. They could afford enough lawyers and lobbyists to swat away civil suits. It would be hell for sex workers on their platforms, but it's not like big tech was showing up for them before. But by giving Congress that win, Sesta Fosta opened the floodgates for legislative attacks on 230. There have been 27 bills introduced that proposed altering or outright repealing it since 2019. And while none of them have gotten as far as Sesta Fosta, it has become a precedent cited by media.
And Congress has carved out exceptions before. In 2018, for sex trafficking, that passed with huge support. So perhaps more carve-outs could be in the offing, David.
All right, Nova, thank you.
Okay, so that clip from the Marketplace Morning Report was from July 2021. In 3 short years, a law that even government officials say probably failed to do most of what it promised has become an example of how to do internet policy. Fucking yikes.
While no new classified site has really filled the void since Backpage, politicians and grifters inside the anti-trafficking industrial complex have found new scapegoat websites to campaign against. Predictably, the ones used by sex workers, like Pornhub, or OnlyFans. which is weird because when it comes to child sexual abuse material, what's found on Pornhub or OnlyFans is just a drop in the bucket compared to what you can find on bigger social media platforms. Earlier this year, in a letter to the Department of Justice, more than 100 members of Congress claimed that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children had identified 80 instances of what they called missing children linked with OnlyFans content. Compare that with 2020, when Facebook identified 20 million images of child sexual abuse material across Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram. Somehow, it's the sites explicitly identified as for sex work that become subject to shutdown campaigns and attorney general investigations, instead of the global platforms with a much broader reach. I wonder what that's about. In a way, though, the change that would genuinely improve sex workers' lives and livelihoods isn't Congress and the DOJ laying off sites that they use, though that would be appreciated. No one is really pushing to get Backpage back. For all its value to sex workers, on a UX and customer support level, Backpage kind of sucked. Most platforms geared towards sex work suck, as Blunt points out.
It's not like these are like great, amazing websites that are kind of changing how marketing and how commerce happens online. It's what we're fucking stuck with.
Blunt doesn't really want a better Backpage. She doesn't want to be siloed off on sex worker-only platforms doomed to become someone's political punching bag. She wants to be able to use the same platforms as other people trying to make money online.
When I think of, like, what do sex workers are like, what do I want out of a platform? I want to be able to buy a fucking Google ad. I can't buy a Google ad. I don't think Hacking Hustling would be able to buy a Google ad.
The only reason Backpage made money is because other tech platforms discriminate against sex workers, in part because sex work is criminalized. Sex workers didn't have many other choices, and now they have one less. Like Katie Simon, an editor at the blog for sex workers Tits and Sass, wrote in her 2018 eulogy for Backpage, "Your owners can sit and stew in the 100 charges in their indictments and take that instead of true justice for cynically profiting off a criminalized population. But I will lament what you meant for us."
Ultimately, in a better world, these platforms of last resort wouldn't need to be mourned because they wouldn't need to exist because sex work wouldn't be a stigmatized, criminalized thing. I mean, in an ideal world, nobody would need wage work to live, but that's probably a whole other podcast.
Great. Who wants to get into all of that? So complicated.
Too much. No.
Not when it's easier to get mad at something bad on the internet. And that's a huge part of this problem, too.
What's easier to explain to lawmakers? The damaging implications to creating carve-outs in somewhat obscure internet and telecommunications law? Or saving children? And what do big nonprofits who fight trafficking get money from their supporters to do? Organize alongside sex workers to identify and stop labor abuses? Or to fight sex workers? Maybe that's the most important thing about taking down Backpage. It was actually pretty easy. Because who was going to listen to sex workers when they said that closing the site was an attack on them too? Because for a lot of people, that was the point. And that's why some people still consider the site's demise a success.
To Daniel Blunt, Kendra Albert, Senator Ron Wyden, Lois Lee, and Nick Pinto for speaking with us for this episode. This episode of RipCorp was written and researched by Melissa Gere Grant and me, Ingrid Burrington, with more research and fact-checking by Matt Giles. Huge thanks to Sam Schuyler for additional research assistance. RipCorp is produced by Megal Gennardin and Mike Vergnetta, with music and sound design by Andrew Atkin and Michael Simonelli. Episode artwork is by Megan Mulholland and Beatriz Lozano. Jason Oberholzer is our executive producer. RipCorp is a production of Charts and Leisure.